Through 1971, baseball in Washington had a rich, albeit mostly feudal history. But it also was noted by the power pitching of legendary Walter Johnson, and, more recently, the power hitting of towering Frank Howard.
There's a long drive to left field! This one is going! It is gone! Frank Howard has just hit home run number 26, and again, he gets a standing ovation! And the cheers for Hondo, who waved his batting helmet to the fans.
That home run occurred on September 30th of 1971, the final game for the second iteration of the Washington Senators, and for more than three decades, was the last time a major league club resided in D.C. Until, of course, the announcement of the Washington Nationals came in late 2004. In the decades since, the franchise has gone from regulars in the cellar to annual pennant contenders, poised to give the city its first World Series title since 1924. But before we discuss the present and future of baseball in the district, let's talk about the past with native Washingtonian and Nationals on-air personality Phil Wood. And I'll begin, Phil, by asking for your recollection on the disappointment level among the fans when the second coming of the Senators left for Texas in 1971. Because this was a team that had only been around for 11 seasons, and the original Senators left in 1960, and this second version came in right after that. Was the mentality around the city that another new team would arrive in short order?
Oh, I think so. Because there was no interruption between the old ball club and the new club, it was a little different because we didn't think when the old club left that it was maybe that big of a deal. The club in 1960 finished fifth, which was pretty good out of an 18 league given where they'd been during most of the decade of the 50s. But the new club came in, and of course Mickey Vernon was a hero of the old club, and he was the manager of the new club, and there were a lot of veterans, and that team got off to a pretty good start in 61, but the wheels finally fell off the cart in June. But I think when the team left following the game of September 30th, 1971, the perception was that a new team would be in D.C. maybe as early as 72. If you look at the newspapers from back then, there was a local attorney named Earl Foreman who announced that he was going to buy the San Diego Padres and move them to Washington in time for the 72 season. Well, that didn't work out, obviously. The guy who owned the Padres at the time, a gentleman named C. Arnold Smith, wasn't ready to sell. But a couple years later, he was, and it looked like we'd get the Padres, but basically, Walter O'Malley, the owner of the Dodgers, found Ray Kroc to buy them and keep them in San Diego. And, of course, the long, dark period at RFK Stadium started right then. But there was a perception, I think, that baseball would be back almost any day. But I think by 1980-81, it seemed like it was clear baseball was going to use D.C. as a bargaining chip with other cities just to get new ballparks built elsewhere. So, the drought continued. And, of course, it probably didn't help that D.C. fans seemed to really embrace the Baltimore Orioles by 1979.
Now, the original Washington Senators, the team of Walter Johnson and the 1924 World Champions, as we said, went on to become the Minnesota Twins following the 1960 season at the choice of owner Calvin Griffith. What was Griffith's main motivation? I mean, I'm assuming money had to do with it, but what was his main motivation for moving the club from Washington, D.C. to Minneapolis-St. Paul? Because RFK Stadium, or D.C. Stadium, as it was called back then, was just about a year away from completion.
Well, it's an interesting story, really. And actually, in 92, at the baseball winter meetings, now, Calvin Griffith had already sold the Minnesota Twins, but he still would go to the winter meetings to rub elbows with his old buddies. And so at the winter meetings in Louisville, Kentucky, I actually had breakfast with Calvin one morning. And actually, I was prepared to not like him at all, but I found him to be kind of a charming guy. And I told him where I was from, and he explained it from the start that he had an issue with where they were building the new stadium, which was back in those days called District of Columbia Stadium. He owned Griffith Stadium, so he paid no rent at all. He owned the concessions, and he owned what little parking there was there. Whereas in a new park, he'd have to pay rent, and he would have to split the proceeds of parking and concessions with the city. So in his mind, it wasn't a very good deal for him, where he was operating on a shoestring anyway. It was a family business. They didn't spend a lot of money on scouting or player development, and of course the results were fairly obvious that they were just not going to win anytime soon. They had signed some good young players in the 1950s, but by the time the end came, following the 1960 season, again, they'd moved up to fifth place, but they were still a few years away from contention. But I think it came down to this. I think he didn't like the fact that they were building the ballpark where they were building it. He actually wanted to see a ballpark built in upper northwest Washington in the Chevy Chase area. And real estate costs then, even then, were much higher than anywhere else in town, so that really wasn't going to happen. So he had an opportunity. He'd been courted by a number of other cities for a number of years. And finally, the people in Minneapolis offered him a fairly new ballpark, rent-free for the first million fans. And, of course, the Senators in D.C. had only drawn a million fans one time in 1946. And basically, he got all the concessions and most of the parking. So it was almost like he owned the place. He still had to pay some rent once they drew over a million fans, which they did. And, of course, by 1965, actually by 64, they were contenders, and then they won the pennant in 65.
Before the Nationals ultimately arrived from Montreal before the 2005 season, there were a number of almost instances in the past in which there was very nearly a team in D.C. or the D.C. region. As a kid growing up in Northern Virginia, I remember the talk of the Astros moving here in the mid-90s, and then there were rumors of the Expos heading down multiple times before it actually occurred. Were there any other times in which you can recall that a franchise in Washington, other than you mentioned the Padres, any other times that you can recall a new franchise in Washington was really legitimately close to happening? And how close did the Astro situation become?
Well, the Astro situation was very, very close, to the extent that the guy who owned the club at the time, Drake McLean, accepted a check for the majority control of the stock of the Astros from Bill Collins, who was a local man of wealth who had actually played minor league baseball. But at that point in time, Bud Selig stepped in. He had become the interim commissioner and then, of course, the commissioner. He stepped in and said to Drake McLean, look, if you'll wait a little bit longer before you go through with this deal, we'll do what we can to make sure Houston builds you a new ballpark. And then on top of that, he turned to Bill Collins and said, look, if you'll back off on this and not sue us, not take us to court, you'll have a club of your own by the year 2000. Well, of course, he was lying through his teeth in terms of making sure D.C. would get a club by the year 2000. And that deal didn't happen. And, of course, they did get a new ballpark built in Houston. But back in the late 70s, you might remember when Jack McKeon was involved in baseball, managing the Marlins, he managed the Reds, he managed the Kansas City Royals, and he managed the Oakland A's. And right after he managed the A's, he moved into their front office, and he was a consultant to Charlie Finley, and he came through Baltimore every so often, and he had managed in the Washington Senators farm system back in the 1950s, and I used to sit with him when he came through Baltimore. And he told me flat out, he said, Charlie Finley would love to move the A's to Washington because he doesn't think the A's, the Oakland situation will ever improve. And he thinks that the club he has, which is heavy on African-American star players, would be a big, you know, an easy sell in D.C. So if he can figure out a way to get out of his lease in Oakland, don't be surprised if he doesn't try to move to Washington. Well, of course, he couldn't get out of his lease, but at least the thought had been planted in his head that D.C. would be a better place. Now, let's also keep in mind, the guys who the ownership of the expansion team from 1961, it was awarded to Elwood Quesada, who had been the chairman of the FAA But he was not a sports guy. He was not a baseball guy. He ends up getting out after the 62 season, and the ownership goes to the Johnston Lemon brokerage firm. And then they ended up selling the team in December of 68. Bob Short buys the team, a hotel magnate, trucking guy from Minneapolis, who actually had previously owned the Minneapolis Lakers and moved them to L.A. So that was on his resume. But the guy he beat out to buy the Senators was the comedian Bob Hope. And Hope backed off on that, on buying them and raising his bid, because he thought he had a chance to buy the Los Angeles Rams. So Short ends up with the Senators. But you look at the ownership throughout the expansion years, and you never had anybody, really, who wanted to put any money into scouting and player development. And, of course, this is pre-free agency. So as a result, the Senators were always lagging behind everybody else in terms of prospects.
In trying to think about those that opposed the Expos coming to D.C. when it was discussed in great detail in 2004, the first person I thought of and remember is Linda Kropp. I think she was like a councilman in D.C. Was there anyone else of prominence that tried to prevent the move, and what were the reasons for opposing it?
Well, I think the reasons for opposing it were the perception that building a new ballpark was probably going to be part of the deal, and a lot of people thought that the district would be spending its money on other things, and certainly they could have. There's no question about that. And I also think there were a number of people who thought that, we kind of have the Orioles now as the home team, so why do we need a team? Why do we need a National League team? And so those kind of things were coming from people who weren't baseball fans to start with. I mean, as a guy who was on the air in the D.C. market at the time, and who had worked in Baltimore, had worked in Washington going back into the mid-1970s, there were a lot of sportscasters in Washington who were not what you'd call baseball-centric. They were much bigger, far more interested in the football team and the local basketball teams, pro and college, and the hockey team. And they kind of thought, well, the Orioles are D.C.'s baseball team. And there were some who actually went on the air, and I said some idiotic things, I thought, at the time. Now, luckily, those people didn't prevail, though I do think it's kind of interesting that you still have a town full of broadcasters, of sports broadcasters, many of whom never show up at the games. I mean, it's almost as if some of them are thinking, well, this is a temporary thing. This club's going to be gone. I mean, there were, when I was on the air in 05, and people were calling me up saying, oh, this team will be gone in 5 years. Baseball doesn't work in this town. You know, people didn't support the Senators. But, you know, there's always been a correlation between winning and attendance. And if you don't win, people don't show up. And let's be honest, the expansion Senators didn't win.
Over the years, and I think really recently, I've noticed somewhat of a class structure when it comes to the conflicting fan bases of the Orioles and the Nationals. There's a group of fans that grew up here and were the fans of the Orioles and then transitioned to become Nationals fans. There's a group of Nationals fans that really weren't interested in baseball until recently because there was no local team. And then there's a group of fans that grew up here and were Oriole fans and stayed that way and thus condemn any Nats fans as something of like a traitor or a bandwagon fan. Do you notice this kind of dynamic as well?
Oh, sure. What's also interesting, though, Brian, is that over the last few seasons, and of course I do the post-game radio show from a little booth out there on the left field concourse, but I've talked to a number of fans from Baltimore who regularly come to Nationals games, and they started doing so when Frank Robinson was the manager of the Nationals. And they were Frank Robinson fans, and they were not fans of the ownership of the Baltimore Orioles. And of course, they had that 14-season stretch where they had a losing record. And so I'm amazed, quite frankly, at the number of Baltimore people who are vitally interested in the Nationals, and I live in the greater Baltimore area, and I see people at shopping centers and just out in public wearing curly W's, and it's always amazing to me. I see as many people wearing Nationals caps in Baltimore County as I do see wearing Orioles caps. So, although Ravens caps tend to trump all of them, but the Orioles, you know, are still in a situation where they have to kind of prove themselves over and over again to the fan base in Baltimore. But the whole issue of people who were who didn't grow up with the Senators and glommed onto the Orioles and stayed with the Orioles. You know, that's, to me, that's fine. I mean, you tend to be faithful to the team you grew up with. I didn't grow up with the Orioles. I grew up with the Senators. I grew up with a team called Washington something. And so, to me, you know, being a fan of the Nationals was just kind of a natural thing. And I find that most of the people who are Oriole fans but live predominantly in the D.C. area, it's simply because it's the team they grew up with. They grew up with the cartoon bird, and they grew up with, listening to John Miller do the games. And, of course, the games were available in the D.C. market for many, many years on both TV and radio. So, I mean, I can't blame them. But, I mean, to me, if you live in this area, you've got the best of both worlds. You've got an American League team and a National League team, and essentially 162 days and nights in a row outside of the All-Star break, there's a live Major League game going on within driving distance. So, you know, what's wrong with that?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Would you agree that the team has been fortunate from a fan interest perspective, as, you know, the novelty of a new team certainly drew well at first, even though they weren't competitive except for 2005 when they had that nice run and finished 500. Then came the new stadium in 2008, and the team still wasn't good. Then came the promise of the highly touted prospects, the Strasburgs, the Harpers, and then the team got really good in 2012, and it's been that way ever since. So do you agree that there really hasn't been a serious lull in fan interest to the point where the average person can't find a reason to pay attention?
Question. I think that the day that everything changed was the day in March of 09 when Jim Bowden was forced out as GM and Mike Rizzo became the GM, and Rizzo was the scouting guy, and Rizzo had a plan in place from the time Mike Rizzo was hired in 06, and he was hired actually by Stan Kasten, the former president of the team. From the time Rizzo was there, he knew he was going to be the GM at some point in time, and of course when Bowden finally imploded, Mike was certainly raring to go, and it wasn't like he was starting from square one, but I think once he showed that number one, he knew what he was doing, and number two, that the learners would spend money on players. I can remember when they didn't re-sign Alfonso Soriano after the 06 season, and people were just, oh, well, the learners are cheap. This team will never contend because this family won't spend money. Well, the fact is, we've seen them spend lots of money on players, lots and lots of money. We saw it again recently with the Max Scherzer deal. So clearly, anyone who's ever spent any time talking with Ted or Mark Lerner or any of the other brothers and sisters, I mean, the Lerner family wants to win, and I think that they understand that despite their success in the development business in terms of developing properties, apartment buildings, shopping malls, etc., leaving the legacy of a winning Major League Baseball team trumps all of that. That's going to be something that people will remember the Lerner family for baseball first, I think, in 25 or 30 years, because I think by then there will be a World Series flag and a World Series trophy somewhere in Southeast Washington.
Three balls, two strikes, the pitch. Swing and a long drive! Deep left field! Going! Let's go!
Another player that they signed, they paid big bucks to get, was Jason Wirth. His walk-off home run in Game 4 of the 2012 Division Series against St. Louis was, in my mind, the best moment of the Nationals' 10-year history. It didn't turn out too well the next night, as the Cards came back to win the deciding game, capped off by the two-out rally in the ninth against Drew Storen. But as far as significant moments go, when you look at, you know, the home opener at RFK in 05, the first game at Nationals Park that ended with the Ryan Zimmerman home run, Strasburg's debut, 14 strikeouts against the Pirates in June 2010, and then the Wirth home run game. Which game do you feel was the most important for this franchise as it builds its own history in D.C.?
Well, the answer I give you is not going to be the answer you're looking for, but
what's
to me, well, it's a game against the Mets played in 05 before opening day, an exhibition game at RFK Stadium, where it was a cold day and it was damp. But here's the Washington Nationals. Here is a team with a curly W on their cap, and it's not an exhibition game of two, you know, on a neutral site by two other teams. This is Washington's team, and to be there at that game with my wife and my two daughters at the same ballpark where my dad took me in, you know, from the time it opened, there was that day had such an impact on me emotionally. I'm sitting with my family upstairs behind home plate, and I can barely contain myself. And that to me is what stands out more than anything. And then after that, I'd say it was the first game of the season when they played in Philadelphia against the Phillies, and I was on XM radio at the time, and I'm doing a show as they're introducing the players on the field, and I'm doing a show with Thomas Boswell of the Washington Post, and as we're sitting there, and we're in the press box, and it's enclosed, so you can't really hear what's going on in the field specifically, but we can see what's going on in the field as the players are being introduced and lining up along the foul line. And Tom and I looked at each other, and like me, Tom is a native Washingtonian, and we both had tears in our eyes. I mean, it was one of those moments when we finished the interview, and I threw it to a break, and he looked at me and he said, "Well, I'm glad I was able to share this with you." And so that, you know, those two games, which happened in the span of just a few days, but that's what will always stick out for me. I mean, the championship games, the playoffs, the Zimmerman no-hitter, you know, everything, all that's great. But the exhibition game at RFK and then the very first game in their history, it was just one of those moments that will stay with me until my dying day.
Two of the main figures of the team now, player-wise, would be Steven Strasburg and Bryce Harper. When you look back at Strasburg and Harper, number one overall draft picks in successive years, both having differing attitudes and styles of play, and both have been scrutinized many times over, do you think the lofty expectations placed upon them was too much when they came to the big leagues, or is it too early to tell?
Well, I think the expectations placed on Harper were insane. You know, he's 15 years old and he's hitting a ball almost, you know, to the farthest point in Tropicana Field, albeit with an aluminum bat. But he's on the cover of magazines. He's so heavily hyped. And he couldn't possibly live up to that. And of course, he hasn't. He was Rookie of the Year. And his numbers, in retrospect, weren't spectacular. They were pretty good, but and then he's quite frankly, because he's been so often injured and unable to play at 100%, I don't think we have any clue how good he's going to be. I do think 2015 is a key year for him, because if you look at this lineup top to bottom, they're not exactly loaded with left-handed hitters. So I think he's got to come up really big this season. Strasburg, another guy who I thought was far too coddled when he first got to the major leagues. I agreed with them shutting him down in 2012 when they did, because he, you know, was coming off Tommy John surgery and he was on a strict innings count, and I, you know, he wanted to keep pitching, but I don't think that was advisable given the investment that the club had in him. But I think as we look now, he's very good, but he's not Bob Feller. I mean, he's not Walter Johnson. To me, clearly the best arm on this staff is Jordan Zimmerman. I think he's shown it time and time again. I certainly hope they're able to re-sign him. I think that even with the addition of Max Scherzer, to me, Jordan Zimmerman is the number one starter on this staff. But, you know, I think that the Nats, with the number one pick overall 2 years in a row, a situation you hope doesn't happen again, because that was emblematic of how bad they were. But they took the players that they felt they had to take, and maybe both will turn into potential Hall of Famers, maybe not. But the draft pretty much is a crapshoot anyway.
As we move forward, they are certainly favored to win the National League East again this year, but they also appear to be pennant contenders for the foreseeable future. Which individual over the next, say, 5 years, whether it be a player, pitcher, manager, general manager, and outsider, which individual does the success of the Nationals hinge on the most?
Well, clearly, I think it's the GM, Mike Rizzo. I think Mike Rizzo is one of those guys that were he to become a free agent GM, they'd be beating down his door. And I'm sure that the Lerner family is aware of that. But to Mike's credit, Mike has surrounded himself with some very smart guys that if Mike would ever leave, I don't think they'd miss a beat. I think that some of the youngsters that they brought in to work in the front office next to Mike are extremely sharp. But I do think everything, the success or failure of this team rides pretty much entirely on Mike Rizzo. I think that Matt Williams was a good hire, but I think he showed in the playoffs that he was a rookie manager. I mean, taking Jordan Zimmermann out of game two, given the circumstances, was a mistake. And I'm not sure he's come right out and admitted it was a mistake. He basically said it's the same thing I would have done during the regular season, but of course it's not the regular season at that point in time. And pretty much everybody in baseball, I think it's almost akin to Pete Carroll calling a pass play with 20 seconds left and you're on the goal line. But I mean, it's I think in time, Matt Williams will become a very good manager. He's certainly a solid baseball guy. If you spend any time talking to him, he's very thoughtful. He defers a great deal to his coaching staff when he makes decisions. Beyond that, to me, because the GM puts the club together and the manager drives it, that's really, that's extremely key. Players will come and go. Free agency and arbitration have dictated moves that the club has made and will continue to make, and there's not much that fans can do about that. But I think as long as you have an ownership willing to keep the club payroll, in the upper 10% of major league teams, although we've seen last year, obviously, the Royals' payroll wasn't that big, and neither the Royals or Giants even won 90 games during the regular season. Postseason play with the advent of the second wildcard team has become it's such a marathon at the end of the season that you just... You can have the best record overall, maybe have the best personnel, but there's an old expression in baseball, anything can happen in a short series.
Yeah, five-game series is done in the Nationals twice in the last 3 years.
Mm-hmm, right.
Thanks, Phil, so much. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure, Brian.